Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Warning, this podcast contains spoilers for my adventures with Superman. Not really, except for the
light spoilers,
thing.
Light spoilers.
Light spoilers. Hello, my name is Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Rosie Knight.
And welcome to X-Ray Vision, the Crooked Media podcast, where we dive deep into your favorite shows, movies, comics, and pop culture.
In this episode, in the previously on, we're talking about something that I know that we're probably both going to love, which is Armando Iannucci's new superhero satire that was recently announced. And we're going to talk about something that's very speculative, but it feels like in 2023 it's worth talking about, which is the potential of a Disney sale to Apple, something that's been rumored in the business for decades, but seemingly, thanks to a Hollywood Reporter article by Kim Masters, looks like it might be being taken a bit more seriously this time around. In the airlock, it's My Adventures with Superman. You guys wanted us to cover it, and we're going to talk about it. It's cute.
It's delightful.
Delightful. Just charming. And in the hive mind, we're keeping the Superman theme going with an interview with Sarah Kuhn and Ariel Jovellanos about their delightful DC graphic novel, Girl Taking Over, a Lois Lane story. And then in the Nerd Out, we got someone talking about another X-Ray Vision fave, which is Nimona.
Coming up, previously on. First up, from Variety, comes the news that Armando Iannucci, the creator of the fantastically funny Veep, has got a new show that has been greenlit by HBO. The half-hour pilot is titled The Franchise, and it follows a hopeful crew trapped inside the dysfunctional, nonsensical, joyous hellscape of a franchise superhero movie making. You heard it here correctly, folks. The creator of Veep is parodying comic book movies, per Variety. Quote, according to an individual knowledge of the project, Sam Mendes, came up with the original idea for the show and put the project together. The pilot was written by John Brown, Keith Akushi, and Armando Iannucci, with Brown and Akushi writing the pilot. Himesh Patel.
Hey, we love Himesh.
Who was wonderful in Station 11. Yeah, and Aya Cash, who was absolutely transcendently evil in season two of The Boys, have joined the cast as series regulars. Very exciting. And I think actually, you know, really smart move.
Yeah,
just from the struck company HBO Max. Yes,
yeah, unbelievably timely. And I will say, very likely that this was already in the works, had already been picked up. They're releasing news at a delayed level, though obviously it is different when it's English people. But yeah, I think this is a great idea. I would love to see it. Iannucci's brilliant. He's like a British legend. He's incredible at satire. These companies deeply deserve to be satirized. I'm sure part of the reason HBO is making this is because if you think about which franchise has been most successful and will most likely be being satirized, this will likely be an MCU satire. It will be about the whole shebang, but let's be real. When you think about the franchise, it's going to probably be in that space of a 20 movies in a row, kind of superhero comic book. Iannucci is a genre guy. He did the really great Avenue 5, I believe it was called, which was the sci-fi.
The Death of Stalin.
Yeah. He also did, if you haven't seen it, and it is obviously a bit off the beaten path of X-ray vision, but his version of David Copperfield that he did with Dev Patel is like one of my all-time favorite movies. I'm not even really a period piece guy, but it's such an interesting, whimsical take on how to tell a story like that. And it's brilliant. Dev is amazing. I love Himesh, so I'm really happy about that. I love so many. Billy Magnuson is great, who's also announced in this. Richard E. Grant, obviously legend. Daniel Brühl, so he's bringing the MCU to the franchise. Yeah, just so many good people. I think this will be hilarious. Who knows when it will get made? I'm sure it will. We'll have to wait for more news. But yeah, this sounds good.
And, you know, on a more kind of noodle-brained note, I think it's telling that you can always kind of tell where you are in the life cycle of a genre or a thing by when the parodies show up.
Yeah.
And, you know, parody satire is kind of like a way of saying, hey, what about this thing that we're kind of tired of? Do we still care about?
Yeah, definitely.
And it seems like the perfect time for that. And so we look forward to it. Up next, The Hollywood Reporter with a big story on the 100th day of the writer's strike about the possibility that it's many analysts and many Wall Street watchers, many media watchers, the possibility that Disney could sell to Apple. Here's a quote from the story. There clearly is no buyer like Apple, which is sitting on $62 billion in cash and cash equivalents and has a $2.8 trillion market cap. And while it may be very true that Apple doesn't want to buy a studio, maybe it wants to buy this studio. And of course, the story goes on to outline various connections between the two corporations, including Pixar, which notably Steve Jobs sold to Disney, and the friendship between Iger and Steve Jobs. But I think, to me, what was most interesting about this piece is that it gets at a reality which everybody understands is coming, and which is also pretty important as a dynamic in the whole, you know, various labor movements that are going on in the industry. And it's that in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, there's not going to be Peacock, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime, Apple TV Plus. There's going to be like three. And they're going to be massive. They're going to be huge, right? Like, you know, Peacock and Disney will reabsorb Hulu contractually, then may sell itself to Apple. You know, Universal may go somewhere. So, like, all of these things, the things that the writers and the actors are fighting for, and IATSE will end up fighting for when their contract comes up, are important because, you know, the life of these deals is going to extend to a time in which the studios become only more entrenched, more monolithic, more difficult to deal with. And so it's pretty important. Also important is the perspective that the Biden administration has not been exactly welcoming of new, you know, mergers and acquisitions. They tried to fight the Activision Blizzard takeover by Microsoft, which they kind of failed to do, but they did stop the publishing one. I forget which the proposed publishing M&A. Anyway, very interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would be surprised, I guess, if a titan like Disney is the one that gets gobbled up. But everybody knows that this will happen. Some version of this will
happen.
Some
version will happen. And this is a rumor that has been going around for like at least a decade in Hollywood circles, in comic shop circles, just people talking about it. The truth is, it seems unbelievable, but Disney in this current market has one of the most profitable, valuable, and dense content libraries. And that is, as depressing as it may be, what these sales are about. And in that way, I do believe that there is a version where Apple may want to be able to have every Disney movie available on Apple TV and also be able to get all the money that they know. Apple has an incredibly insightful understanding of how much money Disney movie makes because they sell them on Apple TV. Like, families buy them and they can see how many times people buy them, how many times people watch them. I'm sure they would love to have that money. I'm sure they would love to be able to own those brands, let alone before you get into how much the parks, the things like Marvel, Star yeah. Wars, all of those things. So it feels unbelievable because Disney is a like monolith. But I believe right now, because of how much they put into streaming, that this is more possible than ever while still being an outlier. They're going to buy someone.
One of the things that has people talking about this again in this kind of very intense, heated way is, you know, one of the signs that media watchers had put out there as a harbinger of perhaps Disney could sell is if Disney starts, you know, selling off, spinning mm-hmm, off mm-hmm. any of its various properties. And the fact that Bob Iger, you know, went on CNBC recently and basically hung a for sale sign on various properties owned yep. by Disney, including ESPN, including ABC, has signaled to people that, oh, maybe this is indeed happening. One tidbit really stood out to me on here. Quoting from the article, Disney's linear networks generated $8.5 billion in profits in fiscal 2022, though that is expected to decline as cord cutting continues. This is why it's important to understand, like, when they're like, oh, this it's a bad business and linear is a bad business. Disney made $8.5 billion.
More money than you could ever imagine.
But it's not enough profit.
That just blows, that sums up everything that's wrong with the industry as it is right now.
But here, this is where we are. One more aspect of this I think is interesting. So I mentioned, like, the Biden administration has mm-hmm. been, and Biden's FTC chair is the most aggressive against tech in particular of any of the FTC chairs in history, I guess you could say. The Biden administration has been more hostile to M&A, mm-hmm. but with the whole DeSantis Disney war of it all, you do wonder, like, okay, would a potential Republican administration be any better? Like, would they put Disney through the ringer mm-hmm. If Disney tried to sell under, God forbid, President Trump or President DeSantis? An interesting thing to look out for.
But
you wonder if they might not want to do it now rather than wait. Yeah.
At the same time, I think another reason, and they point this out in the Hollywood Reporter article, is like that recent overturning of the Microsoft Activision kind of merger where the judge was like, actually, this isn't a monopoly and this is fine. That probably made at least one higher up at Disney go, oh, maybe we could do this. You know, even under this like really hardcore administration, you're still occasionally finding these mergers being allowed to happen. So under a bigger, more generous, like more business-centric administration, like Ron DeSantis or Trump administration, I don't think they'd have any worry.
Well, Microsoft did something smart, which was basically head off any kind of criticism of the monopolistic power of a Microsoft acquisition of Blizzard by basically saying, hey, we promise PlayStation, we promise Sony, and we promise mm-hmm. our competitors, like, we're not going to keep you from the new Call of Duty game or the new Overwatch game. You know, really, Call of Duty is the big one. Like, we're going to let you have Call of Duty. Don't worry about it. Like, we promise we're not going to just shuttle Call of Duty to PC and Xbox. And so that was a way for them to sidestep some of those criticisms. You wonder how Disney would
potentially sidestep
in a similar way.
I also wonder, like, how much of what they're doing right now that seemed was, and again, something people thought Disney would never do, which was like selling off their their stuff that had been on Disney Plus, suddenly they're scrapping it, they're taking write-downs, they're letting other streaming services have it. I wonder if there's something there about like allowing the Disney properties to exist on multiple different platforms rather than them being exclusive to Apple. You know, there's certain things. Now, this would be so unprecedented that it's hard to know, but we are, once again, living through unprecedented times. It would be nice for them to just be precedented, but right now, it's very unprecedented.
I mean, you know, this is kind of an aside, but I think one of the smartest strategies in the streaming era has been Sony, who eschewed the kind of lemming-like dive over the cliff of streaming and instead decided, okay, we're not going to start our own streamer at a cost of billions of dollars in losses every year. We're just going to make content and supply it to whoever the fuck wants it. You know, and you're seeing, like, obviously Disney is doing some of this now. They put Secret Invasion on Hulu, which they own. But, like, you know, I think you're right in that you're going to see everybody who's not Netflix start selling their content all around town. Okay. Up next, the airlock.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now. Meaningful Beauty, beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
We're stepping out of the airlock and into Metropolis for my adventures with Superman on Adult Swim and Max. It's a wonderful anime-inspired love story that really focuses on the relationship between Clark and Lois Lane, who are here in their very early 20s. Jack Quaid as Clark Kent, Alice Lee as Lois Lane, Ishmael Saeed is Jimmy Olsen, and it's really great.
It's delightful.
What did you think?
I thought it's beautiful. I mean, it's so gorgeously animated. From the opening, they kind of showcase that this show understands what makes Superman magical. You get this great kind of origin opening of him as a little kid. The music scores are perfect. The animation, which I believe is Studio Mir, who are just so great. It's gorgeous to look at. Tonally, it's so much fun. I think it speaks, and we'll talk about this in our conversation with Ariel and Sarah that's coming up, but like, it speaks to like the timeless nature of Superman Lois and Jimmy. I mean, Jimmy is the breakout for me, like conspiracy obsessed.
Jimmy is really fun.
Like, he loves aliens. He wants to report to find the truth. Like, he is so much fun. But there's this timeless nature to these characters who have been around this year 85 years. It's their 85th anniversary of Lois and Clark. And this show just shows that you can put them into a different situation. You can showcase them in a totally different way. Here, this is very much a Lois, Clark, and Jimmy story rather than necessarily a Superman story. But it works so well. You want to see
stuff.
Them. They have Superman stuff.
He's Supermaning.
You get fun Superman stuff. They obviously have that the transformation that went viral of him transforming magical girl style. You know, the designs on the costumes are really fun. They fill it with deep cut, weird DC characters, which we always love. I think it's very sad this didn't end up on Cartoon Network, because I think it is legitimately like a perfect Cartoon Network show. But with the whole shenanigans that are going on over there with them shutting down the Cartoon Network building and laying off a lot of people at Cartoon Network, we can imagine that that is not, kids and family is not a focus for Warner Brothers. But it's also cool that it's on Adult Swim, because Adult Swim is, in America, one of the kind of hubs of anime. So to have a show that is so deeply inspired by anime, but that's also in this comics universe, and it debuted, you know, originally at midnight, which at first I was like, oh, they've kind of pushed it aside and they're hiding it. But then I learned that midnight is basically at, that's prime time for Adult Swim, because that's the time that they would always show like the big new anime shows, and everyone's
that's
up
when
late.
Everybody's weed buzz
exactly.
is peaking, and
then, and you turn on and Hunter x Hunter's on there or whatever, like, you know. So I kind of love that it's gotten to be this sort of organic, fun thing that people are discovering. And it's been really lovely, because I can imagine people watching it with their kids. I can imagine people like us who've read a million Superman comics watching it. And it just feels both fresh and totally recognizable. And I think for me, that's something I always really love in superhero storytelling, is like, does it make me feel like it understands the characters while also making me feel like there's a reason it exists, which is to introduce something a little new?
Yeah, here's the thing. On the reason it exists front, one thing I love that DC does, yeah, everybody who's listening to this understands that I've been a lifelong Marvel fan and dipped my toe in DC strategically. But one thing I will eagerly tell anyone that I love that DC does, and I wish Marvel would do, is like, love story centric.
Yes, yes,
shows,
yes, yes, yes.
Issues, like episode, like there was a there's an anthology series, Mysteries of Love in Space. It was kind of recent, which was just like a variety of
the good stuff.
Love stories starring Bizarro Superman, Lois and Clark from Lois's perspective, Green Lantern, I fucking love shit like that. And this show really reminds me of that. And to the in terms of like what you said about like staying true to the characters, this show really hammered home for me one of the things that is deceptively really hard to nail with Superman, which they really do. And that's like, he's obviously like, he is so good. He's a fucking paragon.
Yeah.
He has intense empathy. He just wants to help people. And part of nailing that is getting the reveal right, getting the moment where Lois figures it out, or Clark tells, you know, they've done it different ways, right? I don't want to spoil how they do it in this show, but you've seen it different ways where either Lois figures it out or Clark tells her. And that is such a deceptively hard moment to nail, because if you get it wrong, and different stories have played with this throughout the years, you're basically, you know, Clark is a liar. Clark's lying to Lois for X amount of months, if not years. He's been hiding this secret and, you know, like impugning her journalistic morals. Like there's all sorts of things that this reveal can uncover that's potentially sticky. And this show really nails it.
And
the great Superman stories really nail it, where,
exactly.
where the reveal happens and it's not like, you dick.
No.
Clark, like, you
which
asshole.
For a lot of, like, even, you know, a lot of the comics you'll be reading years and years afterwards and you're like, wait, does Lois like not know? Like, is she dating both of them? Like, what's going on here? But I loved the way they do it in this show. I think you're absolutely right.
I like the way
right.
they do it as well.
They nail it. And also the best thing is, it can be very tempting as a storyteller to have something like that as a huge like end of season hook. But I think that they reveal it at exactly the right time to allow you to continue on your journey with these characters with that knowledge. Also, I love the representation of Superman here. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I cannot remember which one of the creators it was. I wish I could. But one of the creators did a tweet where she was basically like, this is my whole dream has just been to do like wife guy Superman, where he just loves Lois Lane.
Jack Quaid nails the tone.
And like, he is absolutely like, that is who he is like, he just loves Lois. And it is so delightful to see the way that they play with these kind of visual nods that we understand from anime. Like the first episode where they meet, you get Clark with the blushing and he has like the little red cheeks
anime
and the
style
lines.
Blushing.
And it's they have a lot of fun using the visual language of shows like Sailor Moon, of things like, you know, the shonen adventure of like One Piece or Dragon Ball Z or whatever, and merging them all together, but in a way that doesn't feel derivative. It feels like, oh, this is what people who made this show loved. And that feels really special. I think there should be a lot more conversation, a lot more work in a Western comics, and stuff that's inspired by Western comics should be in conversation with anime and manga. And this show does it in like a truly delightful way. Plus, the character designs are great. And every time they introduce a new character, like the cast of characters of DC folks that you get to see in this are so outrageous. And every time someone pops up, you're like, oh, shit, like,
Dr. Ivo.
I fucking love this design. Like, this is so good. So, yeah, it's just...
I mean, they made Professor Ivo into Tony Stark, basically.
And
they
like,
basically made him into Tony Stark.
They had a lot of fun doing it. And, like, the thing that I just... This is the kind of show where I feel like there could be, like, 10 seasons of it, and you just keep watching them. Will that happen in the state of the Strut company, Warner Brothers and HBO, like, as we know it? Or Adult Swim? Probably not. But I want to see more of this.
I will say,
so lovely.
I agree with you. I think they did the reveal at exactly the right point in the season. For all the reasons you mentioned, and plus, like, at this in 2023, I think you're selling out Lois a little bit if she can't, if you know what I mean? Like, you're staring in this person's face. There's pictures of Superman all over the place. Like, at some point, if Lois is worth her salt as a journalist and investigative reporter, she's got to be like, hold on a second.
Right?
So they do that wonderfully. But one thing I will miss post the reveal is another thing this show does great is really nail that dynamic of like when two people in a friend group start crushing on each other
and everybody
knows it, but they deny it.
Yeah.
That they get a lot of really, really great mileage out of it.
They
in this,
do it
where Jimmy's
so
like,
well.
What?
Dude, like, I was thinking about that early. Like, even in the first episode, they have this great moment where, like, Lois and Clark have, like, kind of like an argument. And Clark is in the right and Lois is in the wrong. And, like, they're both, like, I think Lois is talking to Jimmy and then Clark's just, like, talking out on the street and it ends up being one of the Newsboy Legion who comes. And they're both just, like, saying the same shit that they would say to each other. They're like, oh my God, like, I just think I really messed up and I should have done this. And like the Newsboy Legion kid's like 9 and she's like, no, like there's like evil robots, like you need to come and help. And like Lois is talking to Jimmy and Jimmy's like, there's robots. And even from the beginning, like you just know that these two are basically like made for each other. And it's, they do a really good job of making it still feel like there's romantic tension, even you know that those to our end game, which I think is a very hard thing to do. And also, like, I just agree with you. I just think that there's just not enough romance focused stories
imagine,
in superhero comics.
I kept thinking, like, imagine like a Peter Parker, Mary Jane, just romance comic.
Exactly. And
teen
the thing is,
focused just romance.
If you do it well, so like, I will say, you know, we like
if
to
If you
be,
do it well. Well yeah, I mean, you have to, I'm saying, of course,
had,
do it well.
No, I know you are. But like, before anyone comes in and been like, oh, haven't you ever read like the Aunt May teen romance comics? No, I'm talking about something, me and Jason are talking about something like thoughtful and interesting. And like, so if you want to
read and sue.
Yeah.
Reed and Sue meeting and falling in love.
Exactly. Also, like, Rogue and Gambit, look, the age difference. There's a lot of problems, but we all ship them. You can age them up a little bit. It's fine. But, like, those, like, a Rogue and Gambit show like this, are you mad? That would be a hit.
Yeah.
Like, why doesn't that exist? I'm always trying to pick every
Doug
time
Ramsey
I go.
Doug Ramsey and Warlock.
Oh,
listen.
Oh, my God, I would love that. Dude, every time I speak to anyone at DC, I'm like, so what do you think about, like, it's like a webtoon, but it's Swamp Thing and Abby Arcane, and it's like a romance. And they always look at me and I'm like, trust me, people want monster romance. Like, this is the things that the people want. So I love that aspect. And I think that is what makes this show
is
shine.
Fun.
Is like the balance.
This is really fun. Yeah.
Imagine if you're a kid, yeah, and you love, you know, Pokemon or you love One Piece and you watch anime all the time on Crunchyroll or whatever, and you never really got into superhero comics because you're still like 10 and you just haven't read them. Imagine if you find this show, like this can be like your Batman the Animated Series. Now it's going to have a totally different impact, but to see a show like this that understands the tropes and the stylistic flair of the things that you love and takes homage and influence from the shows that you already like, and it introduces you to this legendary, iconic character who's been around for 85 years, that just makes me feel really excited, because I do think this will be that show for a lot of kids.
I completely agree. Really, really fun show. Check it out. Up next, Hive Mind.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, "We are going to give women meaningful beauty." And I said, "That's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life."
Meaningful beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Welcome to The Hive Mind, where we explore a topic in more detail with expert guests. Today, we are thrilled to be joined by Sarah Kuhn and Ariel Jovellanos, who wrote and illustrated Girl Taking Over a Lois Lane Story, along with Beautiful Colors by Olivia Pacini. And we are so happy to have them here today.
Sarah and Ariel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's so nice to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate you two making it possible. It has been a true journey to get you on the podcast. Yeah. And I appreciate you making the journey. So one of the things that we love to ask people here, and I think I can't wait to hear you both talk about it, is like, what was your comic book origin story? Like, what was the thing that made you fall in love with comics? Sarah, I'm going to point to you first because I know you're a comic book lover.
Sure. You know, I think I've probably told a few versions of whatever that story is. So I'm not sure I even know anymore. But I can't remember a time in my life where I didn't have comic books. I grew up with them. I had them in childhood. My brother and I used to haunt the spinner racks at the grocery store when you could get floppies for 75 cents or sometimes even 50 cents. That's really, as we all know, not the case anymore. And I think we started with things like Archie and Superman. I remember the Christopher Reeve Supermans were some of kind of my first big comic book fandom movies. That's really where I fell in love with Lois Lane. And I was a big X-Men kid. You know, we watched the animated series. We collected all the comics. We got super into all the continuity and all of that. So I feel like they've always been in my life. I can't really remember a time when I didn't read them. You know, that might have been my dad, too. He was a big comic book collector. He had a story about how his mother, our grandmother, threw away his collection when he went to college. And that was like a childhood trauma for him for a really long time. So maybe one of the reasons he would literally buy us whatever we wanted, besides the fact that they only cost 75 cents, was that he wanted to like kind of, you know, repurchase his collection, or like whatever the modern version was of that collection. So yes, I've always been a comic book kid, and it's still wild to me that I get to make them now.
Ariel, how about you?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't start off with superheroes. I started off with, I guess, like how most kids do, maybe with like Garfield and Snoopy and just like the Saturday Funnies. I'm obsessed with Garfield.
Me too.
And then from there, I think I kind of transitioned to making my first versions of comics by making kind of strip comics because that's like, that was the first time that I had seen like the form of comics. So the first initial comics that I had made were like very comic strippy, very much, honestly, they were kind of ripping off the plots of cartoon episodes of things that I would seen, especially like they would be ripping off plots of SpongeBob and Dexter's Laboratory, things like that. And then I would just kind of transfer them into comics, but like with my own characters. It wasn't really until that I got into manga that I was sort of reading comics that feel more like the comics that I actually read today and that influence my work today. So the first one that I always talk about, no matter what, is Ranma, which I actually have right here. This was my
Rumiko,
first
the legend.
Manga. Yeah, I love Rumiko Takahashi-sensei. Love her. That the first two volumes of Ranma that I ever bought, those were the two ones that I was completely obsessed with. I collected up to a certain point and read past those two volumes, of course, but like those first two volumes were the ones that I would reread over and over and over again from like middle school on. I didn't even know that that's what it was called, but I would do master studies of the pages and the character designs. And so definitely Ranma has been very, very influential. And then it wasn't really, really until after college that I got into superheroes earnestly. And I fell like deep into like a rabbit hole of superheroes, which I have told the story at multiple times at this point, but I just basically very, very, very long story short, I had gotten into the MCU because of Chris Evans, and then that sort of led me into
understandable.
That sort of led me into genuinely reading superhero comics, especially Young Avengers, was my favorite. And I mean, honestly, I think since, I don't know, my enjoyment of superhero comics has always felt tied to like teen shenanigans. Mm-hmm. So I was like very, very thrilled that Lois wound up being very teen shenanigans, and it wound up being like a very perfect fit for like what I love about comics and superhero comics with Lois Lane.
Well,
and wait, I have to mention my favorite part of that story that Ariel tells, which she didn't include this time, which is when she talks about how she found like Chris Evans and the MCU, and she actually like caught up on most of it through like fan fiction.
Yes, Ducky
fanfic. Yeah, no. That's not my favorite part. My favorite part is that she says it so respectfully. She says, "There was a very nice young man named Steve Rogers, and I have no more about this very nice young man named Steve Rogers." It's so respectful.
Yeah, that's nice. Even though like, he's like 95 years old. Also,
it's so respectful.
She's looking respectfully. She's
looking respectfully at America's ass. I appreciate that.
Of course.
I appreciate that so much.
That is wonderful. Respectfully. That is America's ass, respectfully.
Well, respectfully.
Ariel, you mentioned it. We're here talking to y'all because of your book, Girl Taking Over, a Lois Lane story. Sarah, tell us about the book.
Yes.
Yeah, it's I mean, it's like, it's so funny. I feel like our brains are so dead now because we've been talking about this book for like 3 months, but we never get tired of it. We never get tired of talking about it. But I'm having like that short circuit moment where I'm like, what is that book about that I've been talking about for 3 months? So Lois, Girl Taking Over, a Lois Lane story has the longest title ever. It's about a teenage Asian American, biracial Lois Lane, and she has just graduated from high school and gotten her first internship in the big city. It's National City, which is kind of DC's version of Los Angeles. And I live in Los Angeles, so I was really excited to sort of write in that environment. And she has this idea of what her perfect summer is, what's going to happen, how it's going to be so amazing. And it kind of doesn't totally work out. It actually falls apart pretty much immediately. And so she kind of has to find her own way, make new friends, do a lot of hijinks. You know, that is, has a very Ranma sensibility as well. There's lots of hijinks. And it's kind of the story about how she finds herself, how she finds her voice, and how she falls in love with journalism and becomes a version of the Lois Lane that we all know and love.
Yeah. Ariel, one of the things, I mean, the book is beautiful, and Sarah, I'm a huge fan of all your writing, but this has such a distinct visual language that you crafted with Olivia Petrini, the colorist. Could you talk a little bit about, like, getting to kind of play in this superhero world, but in a totally different visual way than we've ever got to see? You really got to craft a unique world with Sarah and Olivia.
Yeah, and I always say this in all of the interviews, but it really starts with, first, Sarah being, a writer that we've been dying to collaborate on a longer story for ages. And so I think that was just because we could inherently sense that there was something harmonious about, like, the way that we think of stories that would meld very well together, by the time that we would have a script, like a full script. And so the way that Sarah writes is just very, it's very visual. It's very conversational in the fact that when I see her script, I'm like, okay, she is giving me enough, enough description for me to get what she's going for. But she gives me like a lot of runway to play with. And so it really starts with, I think, Sarah's colorful way of describing how she wants something. And then me being able to kind of compute that in my brain and being like, okay, this is what she means. And based off of how I know to play around with visual language, I'm going to translate what she said in words and then try to make it work with a visual. And I think we just worked really well together in that respect. And I think as well that Olivia and Melanie, Olivia are colorist, Melanie, our letterer, also kind of got the vibe too. And I really do think it's a testament to Sarah's like strong writing and direction, as well as our editor, Sarah Miller's ability to kind of keep the ship and the vision like all pointing in one direction, leading us to the same place. And I think that's why the book came out so as well as it did, honestly. Sometimes I like will open it like randomly and be like, damn, we did a really good job. And
it's true. Like,
even months later, I'll be like, wow, damn, look at this. Yeah. This is great. You know? Yeah.
One of the things that really struck me about the book that I loved is just the fashions, the styles. I'm a big fan of that and everything and, you know, all the kind of visual stuff that I end up reading. And I think it's really wonderfully done, particularly with Lois and her roommate, Mickey. Tell us about the creation of the various fashions that these women wear, you know, going to work, going out, and how you chose and ideated on those ideas.
Sarah, do you want to start with how you write it into the script?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, as Ariel mentioned, like Sarah Miller, our editor, was such a wonderful sort of leader and guide for this project. And I think the three of us all have very similar sensibilities about stories and characters and fashion, and especially, you know, as fashion as it related to these characters. Yeah. I always knew that was going to be a really important part of the book. And when we got Ariel on board, we were both so excited because we knew that, like, this book should have so much movement, so much vibrance, so much, you know, expression. And we knew that was something that Ariel is just so amazing at. And like Ariel said, like, she and I had wanted to collaborate together for so long on something. And so when it came to the fashion, the three of us had, like, very detailed discussions about it. And I think I had put some descriptions in the script, but then when we started working on the first character designs, I think I wrote up like a brief that was sort of like, here, you know, we don't have the whole script yet. I think we just had the outline at that point, maybe a little bit of a script, but we were kind of like, we want like this character to sort of look like this, like this is her body language. This is the way she goes about things. This is the way she dresses. Here are maybe some real life inspirations. And we had sort of like different like actresses and influencers who we thought like maybe had a certain style or look that were good inspirations. So I put those together in a brief, and I think I included like some Instagram links and stuff. And then Ariel made these amazing mood boards for each character, kind of pulling from that. But I think like the idea was just, you know, we wanted them to look obviously fresh, obviously modern, obviously like, you know, young people today, instead of maybe like young people when we were all 16. Although honestly, a lot of the fashion from when I was 16 is coming back now. So maybe it's the same. Like sometimes I look at the youth and I'm like, I think I had that exact same outfit when I was your age. But anyway, I just like that was honestly one of the parts that I was the most excited for, because I'd been such a fan of Ariel's work for so long, and I just knew that the fashion was going to be amazing. And so it was a very detailed process. And Ariel, I don't know if you want to talk about like how you kind of created those mood boards and then led into your actual character designs.
Yeah, for sure. So I think in terms of, well, for me, I think something that I've known about myself is that I don't love drawing the outfit that is canon most of the time for any character, because I'm just like, I don't know. I just think that that's not often why there are many, many images of like, character A always dressed in their normal character A outfit, right? So I always try to be like, okay, but like, what would they dress like in this situation or that situation? To be honest, I think that is like an effect of coming from fandom and fan fiction and like fan art. Just, I think that's just like a world that is so indulgent and playful that it just, I can't not do that with any character that I draw. But that said, though, so when it got to having to figure out what all the Lois cast was going to wear, I did enlist two Gen Zers. Just because I was like, okay, what are some of the... Because I was like, I don't, you know, I... Just to make sure that it was like... because I think I'm getting into that stage of my like life where I'm dressing a little auntie. So I got to Gen Z friends of mine, basically, or to help me with the mood boards, where I would just pick and choose some things myself. I would direct them, and then they would sort of like help me extrapolate on like what else these characters might wear. That especially helped with the fact that there's such a large cast, mm-hmm. and Sarah was very, very distinct in describing who each character was, even if they were just like a side character. And I think it was just like helpful to divide and conquer a bit on getting at least the research done. I always think that comics, at least for me, it's always been like a team sport, mm-hmm. where just because on the visual side of drawing a comic, like the artist is responsible for, you know, quite a lot of things, like drawing like the set, drawing like the characters, the body language, thinking about the clothing. There's all these like different things to think about, and wherever I can like ask for help, mm-hmm. in these situations, I always try to ask for help. And so I think my two fashion assistants, Jamarie Garcia and Alinda Zhao, they definitely both helped in capturing the language of the fashion. And then from there, it was easy for me to sort of be like, okay, these are the references. How can I extrapolate this further? How can I maybe like cartoon it up, mm-hmm. a bit? And honestly, yeah, I'm obsessed with every outfit, and I think I would wear all of it, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was funny because whenever Sarah Miller, the editor, mm-hmm. and I would get like new pages, we would be like, wait, do I need a beret? Like, do I need a Letterman jacket? Like, every single time we were like, I feel like I need this outfit now. And it's unfair that it doesn't exist in real life. Like, we were so inspired to like go buy things for ourselves, even though we're not Gen Z. That is very inspiring.
Oh, man. Berets and Letterman jackets. Yeah, that will, I think for me, I'll always sneak in a Letterman jacket, and I'll always sneak in a beret. I'm always like, you know what that character needs? A jacket with a patch that indicates some part of their personality on it.
I've seen an Avatar crew fan art by you where someone's wearing a Letterman jacket. I was like, I'm sure that this is an Ariel trope. Everyone's wearing one. Different one for each bender power.
Yeah, of course.
One of the reasons like I've been super stoked to have you on the show is like this is the 85th anniversary of Lois Lane and Superman, sure, but like Lois Lane too. And a book actually came out on the anniversary, which I thought was really lovely. Sarah, I'll start with you. Like, what do you think it is about Lois Lane? And, you know, to a latter part, if you want to, about Clark or Superman, but like, what do you think it is about Lois that's made her resonate for so long that you can have a graphic novel for young readers created by people like us, our age, who loved this stuff, but who weren't even the first audience for it?
Yeah. I mean, there is something about her that is both like compelling, like very specific, but also timeless. Mm-hmm. She's a character that is a bit elastic in different ways, because you can sort of make her fit different scenarios, different time periods, but she always feels like Lois. And I think that was something that we really tried to drill down on, like, what is that? What, you know, how can we make sure this is definitely Lois? And, you know, like I said, like my first like falling in love with Lois moment was really those Christopher Reeve Superman movies. I just thought Margot Kidder was so amazing. Like, she was really the one that I zeroed in on. Like, Superman was fine, but she was the one that I was like, this movie is like all about this person. She is the main character. We are discovering Superman through her eyes because she's, you know, the human. Mm-hmm. She's kind of like the audience's way in. And I just always loved that she was so tough and so outspoken, and she would never allow herself to be the sidekick or the sort of girlfriend or the love interest. Like, I think with some stories like that, with, you know, superheroes or these sort of larger than life franchises where maybe it was about a man and the man had a love interest or a girlfriend or whatever, a lot of times that character was kind of a throwaway. She was just very pretty and like complimented everything he did and thought he was so amazing and, you know, was very sort of blank slate accessible. And Lois was the opposite. She was very outspoken. She was very ambitious. She cared about getting the truth. She would sort of go after something and never give up. She was extremely tenacious. She would take up space. Mm-hmm. She would really not allow herself to be pushed to the side. And I think that's something that probably appeals to a lot of us. I think to a lot of us, I know that's something that appeals to writers, because I think when you're writing something, you're trying to get to a truth, whether it's an emotional truth, whether it's a narrative truth, whether it's a truth that exists just for that character, like whatever it is, you are always trying to find a truth and kind of unearth that and beam that out to whoever is reading your story. So Lois, I think, for me, has always been very powerful. You know, the moment I have talked about a few times in interviews is the end of Superman 2, where the whole, you know, the whole movie, she's been on this kick where she wants this fresh squeezed orange juice to be like healthy. And then the end of the movie, she basically orders Clark to go get her a hamburger with everything on it and the fresh squeezed orange juice. And it's like 9 a.m. And she's like, yeah, I know. Go do that for me. And I was like, oh my God, like, is this my goal? Like, this is my goal. Like, this is like what I want my future to look like. And so I think there is just something about her that, again, is so specific, but can also be morphed to different time periods and different ages and different settings. And so it is the biggest compliment, I think, to both of us when someone is like, you know, this is Lois Lane. This is not like a Lois Lane we've seen before, but there is something about her at her core that she is undeniably Lois Lane.
To that end, I think one of the most surprising things about this book for me as a person who came up through digital media and journalism, Rosie the same, is the way it prepares the young readers of today for the realities of digital media through Lois's adventure out to National City and arrival at the office of Catco, only to discover that Catco has been gobbled up by some large media conglomeration, and her hero editor chief has been jettisoned, and now she's got to figure it out. I mean, listen, that is a reality that everyone who's ever worked in digital media has faced at some point in time. And talk to us, Sarah, about bringing that to the page and making that part of the story.
I mean, I'm glad that you could feel seen and hopefully not too traumatized.
Seen and traumatized.
I'm also glad it came off as realistic. Yeah. I mean, my background is I was a journalist. I was my own little Lois Lane. Like I did that for a long time. That's what I did in college. That's what I did after college. I had several media jobs after college that I did full time before I became a freelancer and then eventually a novelist and comic book writer and all of that. And so I have a great deal of affection for that world. And when I was kind of starting out in journalism, it was sort of, I guess, the web 1.0 boom and then bust, very, very quick bust. But I worked in that environment for a while. And I think I got, you know, that sort of sense of like, when I was a kid, I had sort of imagined it as like, oh, you get this one job. And I remember like, I loved Sassy Magazine. Sassy Magazine at the time was sort of like, it was like the Bible for sort of the alternative teenage girl who wanted to be outspoken and, you know, was into like Riot Girls and zines and kind of all the things that Lois ends up being into. And so I think I had this fantasy of like, oh yeah, you get a job at like a Sassy Magazine at like the entry level, and then you just stay there forever, and then you live this like amazing glamorous life in like New York City or San Francisco or LA or like some amazing metropolis where, you know, every day is just like you having these adventures and like, I don't know, like,
and you can pay rent and you can buy a house,
eating free muffins and having health insurance, like, you know, and so like when I actually started working in media, I think then, and to be clear, I loved every journalism job I had. I think like they were all honestly awesome. Like I had such a good time. I made great friends. I still have fans from like my journalism days who have followed me into this second career. And so I think like, you know, that was something that I thought would be kind of fun to explore with Lois, that like, she has this kind of idealized version. She knows what she wants. She's going to go after it at all costs. But her vision of that is so specific and so kind of glamorized and so not exactly based in reality. You know, I think she also has this idea, if I just work hard enough, I will be rewarded over and over and over again in a very fair and equitable way. And, you know, I think we probably all have that moment where we realize that perhaps the job that we love may not love us back to the same degree, or if we love the job, the corporation may not love us back to the same degree. You know, so many things can happen over the course of like even a year. That especially now, it feels like the media landscape is kind of the Wild West.
Truly.
So I thought that was kind of also an important reality to reflect. And I also kind of wanted to show that, like, you know, I think all of us also go through our own story arc of realizing, you know, as cheesy as it sounds, the real power is in you. The real power is your voice. No corporation, no media job, no like newspaper or magazine or whatever can give that to you. And especially now with all of these avenues to sort of get your voice out there and your work out there yourself, I thought that was something that was important for Lois to realize, that the real power is her. It's not a job. It's not a certain college. It's not a certain paper. It's not a certain internship. It's really her voice that she just needs to be brave enough to express. And again, I'm glad that resonated with people who are working in media during these trying times.
I love that everyone can just like, whenever they're having a rough time or they get laid off, they can just come back and listen to that speech you just gave and be like, just got to make the zine, man.
I mean, I was laid off so many times during my media career. Like, I was laid off so many times that I feel like, you know, I understand that. I understand what that's like. And, you know, that was something I had to realize, too, that my power was not in a platform someone else had given me, or a publication I didn't create, or someone who had given me a job. Those were all very nice things. But my true power was like in my voice. And that's something that I think everyone, I hope, can realize for themselves eventually.
I love that. And okay, so more on a less existentially relatable, but also like the terrifying level. So this is obviously one of the I love this line of DCYA graphic novels that Sarah is the brilliant editor of. Do you guys have like a dream sequel story you would want to tell? Like, Ariel, are you trying to put Clark Kent in a Letterman jacket with a giant S on the back?
I would love to put Clark Kent in a Letterman jacket. See, the thing is, though, okay, I've told Sarah my dream is like a himbo Superman situation. Here's the thing, though. Like, since the book has come out, another thing has come out, which I'm like, whoa, which is My Adventures with Superman on HBO. Yeah. Max.
How could you?
And first, whenever I see it, I'm like, oh my God, the My Adventures with Superman Lois and the Girl Taking Over Lois, like they're shaking hands. Like they are like the meme of like
they're
shaking
like,
because
they're like the Spider-Man pointing at each other.
Yes. They are like very, and I think that speaks to what you were saying, Sarah, that like Lois is Lois in what, like when a writer or like when a team gets Lois right, you will sense that it is Lois. And there's definitely something right about the My Adventures with Superman Lois. That said, if we could do a graphic novel that is about our Lois meeting Clark, and basically Clark just following her around and being like, oh, yes, Miss Lane, let me help you with that. I would love that. That would be like while Lois is off, was chasing some like groundbreaking story and Clark just like assists her. I would love that. That would be great. that would be the story that I would want.
Ariel kept saying Himbo Superman, like Himbo Clark Kent. And that was something I just feel like we need to see from her. Like, we need to see her version of that, I think, definitely. But yeah, I mean, obviously, we had so much fun working on this book. We love Sarah Miller, our editor. We love the whole team. We would love to do some kind of, you know, follow up at some point. And we had a lot of ideas, but definitely Himbo Clark Kent kept coming up whenever we were doing interviews.
Well, Sarah and Ariel, thank you so much for joining us. The book's wonderful.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah and Ariel. Up next, Nerd Out. In today's Nerd Out, where you tell us what you love and why, a theory you're excited to share, or a quick question we can answer, Ashley pitches us on the 2023 film Nimona, based on the beloved, groundbreaking comic by N.D. Stevenson.
Hi, Jason and Rosie. This is Ash, a longtime listener. I wanted to send a Nerd Out suggestion, request, beg you guys to talk about this amazing comic and now movie, Nimona, by N.D. Stevenson. It is so refreshing. It has amazing music, incredible animation, great voice acting. It is on Netflix, and it is such an amazing allegory about gender and about being an outsider and about learning to question the world around us and find our place in it and accept who we are and the people around us. As someone who's been going through the gender fuckery on my own, it was amazing to see this story. And as someone who has a 7-year-old, she was able to watch this and was just entranced with every moment of it. And it was truly such an amazing, amazing experience. And I really hope that more people see this and talk about this. And just, oh, it was so good. Thanks for all that you guys do.
Thanks, Ashley. If you have theories, passions, or quick questions you want to share, hit us up at xrayatcrooked.com. Instructions, as always, are in the show notes.
Thanks to Sarah and Ariel for joining us. And that's it for us. Rosie, any plugs?
You can still just read my IGN piece. We have got, I can't believe
it's
I'm
great.
Saying this. I
really,
don't
really
read,
great. Check
I
it
don't
out.
Read the comments, but the oral history of the boom and bust of comics on IGN. Actually, it has been reported to me by multiple places that it has very positive comments of just people being excited to remember this era in their life. So I think if the piece can make a comment section happy, then it's a good piece. So I'm feeling very happy about that. I'm very proud about it. So just go and read it and listen to some comic legends saying some hilarious things.
Catch the next episode of X-Ray Vision Wednesday, August 16th.
Until then, you can watch full episodes of the podcast on YouTube. You can also check us out on Twitter at XRVPod and join our Discord to hang out with lots of cool fans.
5-star ratings, 5-star reviews. We got to have them. You got to give them to us. Here's one from Trackman. I'm a Trackman. Best pop culture podcast out there. Wow.
Thank
Jason
you.
And Rosie, a really delightful combo of ridiculous amount of pop culture knowledge. I relish their comics recommendations and I appreciate their insightful approach to breaking down shows and movies. Thank you, Trackman.
Appreciate it.
Before we go, I wanted to share some news about X-Ray Vision. After 2 wonderful years making pods and digital series here at Crooked Media, we are taking X-Ray Vision independent.
Woo!
Making the show has been such a delight. Connecting with the audience, talking about the stuff we love has been a wonderful, wonderful pleasure. I'm sure you want to know what this means for the pod. We're going to find a home for it. And because of certain business things that you don't need to worry about, you're not going to need to subscribe to a new pod once we get that home for the pod, which should be shortly, hopefully. Knock wood. All you're going to have to do is check your feed and it'll pop up. You'll also get messages from Rosie and I about when that will happen. More information on our final show, which will be next Wednesday.
X-Ray Vision is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Chris Lord and Saul Rubin and executive produced by me, Jason Concepcion. Our editing and sound design is by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Video production by Dylan Villanueva and Rachel Gajewski. Social media by Awa Okolati and Caroline Dunphy. Thank you to Brian Vasquez for our theme music.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Relax this Sunday with a little moment to yourself and the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.